Well, for most of the 20th century, much debate on the left revolved around the Russia question. That is, what to say about the society that existed in the USSR, as well as those in the many other countries that describe themselves as being socialist. And it's obvious why this was the case. Any halfway serious political person who called themselves a socialist, or even more broadly, who opposed capitalism in some way, had to figure out what they thought about what was known as the socialist third of the world. And find out how someone answered this question, and you'd be a decent way along the path of understanding them politically. And this is because the Russia question was not simply about Russia, it went to your whole conception of what socialism was, of the meaning of human liberation, and the strategies needed to achieve it. It was, as one writer put it, the touchstone of theoretical and practical attitudes which lay claim to revolution. Now, most of the left, outside of the social democratic parties, and indeed some within those parties, answered the question of whether Russia was socialist in the affirmative. That is, they identified their own vision of what society ought to be like, partially, in some cases, completely, in others, with the societies that really existed in countries like Russia, China, Cuba, Vietnam, etc. Now, many good people joined the Communist parties for admirable reasons, because they were working class militants, because they recognised the injustices of capitalism and wanted to fight for a different society. But the socialism that they aligned themselves with had nothing to do with Marxism. Stalin's brutal one-party dictatorship in Russia represented not the continuation of the Russian Revolution, but its defeat. To consolidate power, Stalin had to obliterate everything that was revolutionary in Russia, including, in the end, all of those who had led the Bolsheviks and led the revolution in 1917. So I would argue that the fact that so many people who hated capitalism identified themselves with the monstrosity of Stalin's Russia was really one of the great tragedies of the 20th century. There were many people, though, who rejected the claim that the socialist states had anything to do with socialism or, more broadly, with human liberation. But the problem was that most of them rejected not only Stalin, but rejected the Russian Revolution itself. They accepted the formula that was put forward by both the Stalinist apologists of the society in the USSR and also the Cold War warriors and defenders of Western capitalism. That is the formula that Lenin equaled Stalin. The Trotskyist current, though, that's the current that Socialist Alternative has its origins in, was different. It put forward, and was unique in doing so, a critique of Stalinism that was based on support for and defence of the 1917 revolution. Their argument was, as Trotsky put it, that Stalin was the gravedigger of the revolution. But at the end of World War II, some years after Trotsky had been murdered by an agent of Stalin, the Trotskyist movement split into a series of warring groups divided over their analysis of the USSR. Some, led by Max Shachtman, developed a theory of bureaucratic collectivism to describe the Stalinist regime. This led him, although not all who agreed with this theory, to see Russia as being worse than Western capitalism. And the logical conclusion of this, just think about it, is to side with the West in the Cold War and to end up supporting things like the barbaric imperial project in Vietnam. Different were the so-called orthodox Trotskyists, who stuck to the letter of Trotsky's analysis that Russia was a degenerated workers' state. That is, they claimed that although the state machine was controlled by a Stalinist bureaucracy, the state was still, in its fundamental form, a tool of the working class by virtue of state control of industry. And this led them to characterise Stalin's Russia as being fundamentally superior to the West. The problem with this view became clear after World War II, with the Russian takeover of Eastern Europe. Because in none of the Eastern European countries were there workers' revolutions, and yet in a very short space of time, these states were organised on almost identical lines to the state in Russia itself. And so if you accepted that these societies that looked like the socialist or workers' state in Russia, if you accepted that these societies were socialist, then you had to accept that it was possible to bring about socialism without a working class revolution. And not only that, you had to concede that counter-revolutionary Stalinism, and that's how the Trotskyists had characterised Stalinism, that counter-revolutionary Stalinism had in fact played a profoundly revolutionary role in world politics. It had brought socialist rule right into the heart of Europe. And having this analysis had serious ramifications for practical politics. After all, if it is possible to avoid the long and difficult road of revolution, well, why wouldn't you do so? And it was a short journey from the characterisation of the Eastern Bloc as a workers' states to thinking that Mao's peasant armies in China, Castro's guerrillas in Cuba could introduce workers' power somehow. Since working class revolution was no longer necessary, well, why not look to any populist, bourgeois nationalist or bourgeois leader as a potential bearer of socialism? So the political current based on the analysis of the British socialist Tony Cliff, in whose tradition socialist alternative stands, began as a reaction against this fundamental break with Marx's conception of workers' self-emancipation, the idea that the only way the working class could create socialism and was through its own revolutionary actions. Cliff argued that Stalin had carried out a counter-revolution in Russia and restored capitalism, if in a bureaucratic and statised form. The Eastern Bloc countries, Cliff said, were also capitalist. And from this, he argued that the two imperial blocs in the Cold War were essentially the same, that a full-blooded workers' revolution was needed in both the East and in the West. And the slogan that summed up this approach was neither Washington nor Moscow, but international socialism. Now, Cliff's socialist review group battled away for years as one of many political currents and small political currents, by and large, claiming to be the inheritors of Trotskyism and the real inheritors of classical Marxism. Throughout these years, they were on the outer margins, all of them, of the workers' movement in most countries. And yet, this didn't make the battle between the Trotskyists any less fierce. Indeed, mountains and mountains of paper were sacrificed in the intensely fought polemics between them. And, these debates over Russia, and particularly the debates between the Trotskyists, are widely sort of mocked in society. Most people here will probably be familiar with the famous Monty Python piece about, the People's Front of Judea and the Judean People's Front. Yes, people are. That, fought out this seemingly arcane, mad dispute about some sort of abstract theological point that no one in the outside world could possibly understand what they were talking about. But I would argue, in spite of Monty Python, that the ferociousness of the battle over the Russia question was entirely justified. I'm not saying this because I'm in favour of arcane debates or splits over questions that it's possible to agree to disagree about. Any mass socialist movement will invariably contain all manner of opinions about a large number of questions. But the debate over Russia was in no sense arcane. It was a battle for the soul of socialism. The struggle to rescue the heritage of Marx from Stalinism, to insist that socialism was about workers' democratic control over society, or it was about nothing at all, I would say that this argument and this battle was worth 1,000 splits, 1,000,000 bitter polemics. And I think we can say now that the reality is that the international socialist analysis has been utterly vindicated by events, in particular the collapse of the USSR, where millions of workers rose up and overthrew the so-called workers' states in an inspiring series of revolutions starting in 1989. And I think the legacy of Clif and the IS was that they kept the flame of real revolutionary Marxism alive through the long decades of Stalinism and in the face of a massive ideological retreat and massive confusion on the left against seemingly impossible odds. And really, I think, you know, we can't overstate the importance of this achievement. But, okay, that's the past, you know. Things have changed. And it's true. The USSR is no more. No one, even today, different to a few years ago, seriously thinks of China as being a communist society. The countries that claim to be socialist still, countries like Venezuela and Cuba and so on, in no way compare to what Russia and China were like. They are peripheral to politics, mass politics, everywhere outside of Latin America. The Russian Revolution, you know, took place nearly a century ago now, 90 years ago, in a radically different country, in a radically different world. Not just Russia was a long time ago. Actually, even the fall of the Berlin Wall is now in the dim and distant past. It did not happen in the lifetime, let alone the political lifetime, did not happen in the lifetime of the generation of young people who are leaving school and entering university or the workforce today. And since the collapse of the Berlin Wall, the major political shocks that have impacted the left, first the war on terror and now the world economic crisis, these things have got no immediate connection to debates about the class nature of the former Soviet Union. And so I think because of these factors, we can say that the Russia question is nowhere near as central to politics today as it was in the past. We are, there's no denying it, living in a new epoch. But does that mean then that the Russia question's faded into history? Well, I would say that it hasn't. First of all, because the capitalist class did not stop attacking the Russian Revolution with the collapse of the USSR. The revolution is still taught, at least here in Victoria, I know in schools, in Year 12 history in particular, and the way it's taught, although it varies depending partly on the teacher you have, the way that it's taught, the purpose of it is, I think, incontestably to demonstrate that any attempt to fundamentally change society will end in catastrophe. And it's not just people who've done Russian Revolution's course in Year 12 history. Think the main objection that people still raise to socialism, people who come along to our meetings and so on for the first time who are interested in radical ideas, the main objection they still raise is that socialism is a good idea in theory, but it would never work in practice. And overwhelmingly, the experience of Russia is the historical proof for this contention. But as well as the attacks from the ruling class, the association of Stalinism with Marxism is still at the centre of the anarchist and more broadly the libertarian critique of socialist politics. A couple of years ago, there was an interesting online debate between the US socialist Alan Muss and the libertarian ZNet writer Michael Elbert on the question of the relevance of Marxism. And an interesting debate, but a frustrating one, as no matter how hard Musk tried, he could not convince Elbert to debate him on the Marxism that the ISO, the International Socialists in America, stood for, as opposed to the Marxism as represented by the leaders of the so-called Marxist states. So in one part of the exchange, Musk wrote, "If Elbert thinks a debate with me and the ISO about the relevance of Marxism is useful, then he should address himself to our Marxism, not the fake Marxism of bureaucrats and dictators that we have always rejected and opposed." Okay, Elbert replied to him. He said, "I think I am speaking to the core views of Marxism, period. I think our disagreements indicate that. You wouldn't let an open, you wouldn't let an advocate of capitalism say, don't talk to me about depressions, about starvation, about wars and colonisation. That's just bad capitalism. I'm for good capitalism. I won't agree to talk about Marxism and simply ignore what virtually all Marxists say they are for when they present institutional vision, what they have done and what they do when they are in power. Okay, but the reality is that there's no answer to this other than to establish that what happened in Russia is not simply bad Marxism, elements of Marxist politics that we would be better off without, just as a capitalist might prefer capitalism without economic crises. Actually, we need to establish that what existed in Russia and the other socialist countries had nothing to do with Marxism at all. And Marx drew this conclusion from the debate. He wrote, "People on the left today consider the Russian question to be a matter of historical debate, if they're familiar with the issues at all. Certainly nothing with relevance to today's world. But I think that the debate between Michael Elbert and myself has shown that our answers to the Russia question are still very important." And I agree with him very much on that. Because how could, for example, the democratic socialist perspective in Australia, the people associated with Green Left Weekly and the Socialist Alliance, how could they possibly put the case Musk did when they systematically gloss over the true nature of Stalinism and compare it favourably with the West? And I was an anarchist debating them, and I admit I once was an anarchist. If I was, I'd go straight to their website and talk about how, after a few ever so moderate words about the distortions of socialism in Russia, where people's self-administration was stifled, they say, by a privileged elite of state officials, after these meek words of criticism, they go on to say, "Nonetheless, for a while, these economies enjoyed dramatic growth, largely due to the benefits of a planned economy. Without that, the Soviet Union would never have been able to develop from a largely peasant into an industrial society and to defeat the Nazi invasion in World War II. Now, the period of industrialisation that they're talking about is the period of the development of the gulags, a huge system of slave labour prisons that prefigured Hitler's concentration camps. It's the period of the infamous show trials in which scores of leading Bolsheviks were forced under torture to renounce their views and to confess to being traitors to the revolution. The period of forced collectivisation, the list goes on. And such despicable statements are not only applied to history. This is what they have to say about the remaining countries that call themselves socialist today, and I'll quote it at length so that there's no chance I can be accused of misrepresentation, so apologies if you don't like long quotations. They write, "It's actually misleading to call any of the existing countries where capitalism has been overthrown socialist, since socialism involves the use of the world's resources to meet human need. It can only exist on a world scale. So the socialist countries are countries on the road to socialism. That said, we consider all of the countries where capitalism has been overthrown as great gains for the peoples of the countries concerned and for workers all over the world. These countries have our solidarity. We defend and support them unconditionally. At the same time, we distinguish between those where bureaucracies have usurped the political rights and power of the working people, China, North Korea, and those where the governments, despite innumerable difficulties, act in the working people's interests, Cuba, Vietnam." I think that anyone could claim that North Korea is on the road to socialism is a vile insult to everyone who has ever fought and sacrificed for the socialist cause, let alone the claim that in countries like Vietnam, the government is acting in the working people's interests. If any of this rubbish is socialism, then I, for one, want no part in it. So that's specifically about the analysis of the Stalinist states. But there's also a series of other questions that go right to the heart of revolutionary politics, which flow from your analysis of Stalinism, but are not directly necessarily about Russia. Take, for example, the women's movement, the rise of what's known as patriarchy theory in the West, the idea that women's oppression is a result of a specific interest of men in oppressing women, was actually closely connected to the question of socialism in Russia. The reason is that the basic Marxist argument that women's oppression is a product of class society was fatally undermined if you accepted that Russia was in any way a workers' state. As anyone but the most hardline Stalinist could tell you, that women in Russia were still oppressed. So if you accept Russia's socialist, well, what can you possibly conclude? Only that there must be other structural reasons for women's oppression, as that oppression could exist, even if class divisions in society did not. Or, you know, another example, look at the debate, the political debate in the Arab world. There, the main negative result of Stalinist domination of the left has not actually been to do with the characterisation of Russia, but the idea that the working class movement needs to align itself with and support subordinate its own independent class organisation and interests to the interests of the so-called progressive nationalist bourgeoisie. And this approach led to disaster after disaster, destroying what were at times large communist movements in countries like Iraq, Egypt, Iran and elsewhere. In the case of the Palestinians, this class collaborationist approach underpinned the strategy that led Fatah to ruin and which Hamas, for all its seeming radicalism, rejuvenates today. Now, of course, it's no surprise that these organisations, led as they are by non-working class forces, would adopt a cross-class or a class collaborationist approach. The tragedy has been that the left has not been able to mount a challenge to the prevailing orthodoxy because it accepts... It accepts the core premise of the need for Palestinian and Arab unity, a premise which in practice means subordinating the interests of workers to those of the Arab capitalists. I think a new socialist movement in the Middle East will have to come to grips with the colossal failure of Stalinism, which will be extraordinarily difficult to do without developing a thorough critique of what went wrong in a broad sense. Mamdou Habashi was explaining to me in the last couple of days how a majority of Marxists in Egypt are not even in any socialist organisation, as they've been so burned by the disasters of those parties in the past. And I would say that understanding those disasters is crucial to convincing people that a socialist party can be different to what people have previously experienced. And I think this, the issue of socialist organisation, the party question, has been really disfigured beyond recognition by the Stalinist legacy. The history of the bureaucratic, monolithic Stalinist parties of the past has undermined the argument in favour of building revolutionary socialist organisations in the eyes of many thousands, I would say, of radicals across the world. The hostility to party building, as it's called, on the left today is, I think, inextricably linked with the perception that what groups like Socialist Alternative are doing replicates the project of the old Stalinists, who, instead of aiding revolutionary and radical movements, actually stifled them, constrained them, subordinated them to the narrow interests of the party, and in the end, betrayed them. So that's one element to it. But the other side is that many who agree on the need to build revolutionary organisations accept at least part of what the Communist parties did as a legitimate expression of Leninism. So we've seen, and I think we still see today, organisations which denounce Stalinism and yet, on the party question, in practice, adopt many of their methods. So it's been common practice on the far left to demand, usually in the name of democratic centralism, a rigid adherence to the party line, unquestioning loyalty to the leadership, restraint from public criticism, bans on factions, all backed up by the threat of disciplinary measures. Now, I think that no organisation that's built on these lines could ever hope to cohere in its ranks the thousands of independently minded working class militants without which it is impossible to conceive of a mass revolutionary workers' party. But perhaps the greatest distortion that Stalinism has introduced to the left is the association of Marxism with a strong state, with statized industry. Marx's most famous book, The Communist Manifesto, goes through at great length the process by which the state withers away as socialism progresses. Lenin wrote in 1917 about how the workers' state was not really a state in the normal meaning of the term, as it replaced the separate bodies of armed men elevated above society with the mass of working people, part of society, constituting themselves as a ruling armed force. The Trotskyists, though, who argued that Stalin's dictatorship was some kind of workers' state, had to junk this whole analysis. Socialist industry, for them, stopped being about industry under workers' control. It simply became industry run by the state. And this analysis fits like a glove with the reformist vision of socialism, which is similarly about state ownership of industry separate from any notion of workers' democratic control. And I think if you believe that the existing state can be made to serve the interests of workers, you've deserted revolutionary politics in favour of attempts to improve workers' conditions in the framework of the existing system. And I think this has been the fate of every radical current that has not been willing to confront the power of the state as an irreconcilable enemy. Okay, so the Russia question still matters for the left. But I suppose, how exactly does it flow through? Is it legitimate today to simply write off individuals and organisations as lost to revolutionary politics on the basis of disagreements about their exact characterisation of Russia? Well, I'd say no. It's not justified purely on that basis. It's one thing to say that any new socialist movement needs to be built on the basis of a clear and unequivocal rejection of Stalinism. I think that is uncontestable. It's another thing to say, and I think it would be wrong to say, that we should set up acceptance of the theory of state capitalism that Socialist Alternative has as some kind of revolutionary bar you have to prove that you can leap over. 2 decades after the collapse of the USSR, I think it's perfectly conceivable that individuals or organisations could accept all kinds of theories to do with the class nature of Russia and yet be genuinely committed to working class liberation and revolution. Now, in my view, there would be a logical contradiction in such an outlook, but actually I think revolutionary politics can tolerate logical contradictions up to a point. You know, think there was a contradiction at the heart of the Bolshevik position on the fundamental nature of the Russian Revolution right up until April of 1917, when Lenin won the party over to a struggle for Soviet power. And yet few, I think, would argue, and I certainly wouldn't, that it was only at this moment that the Bolsheviks became a genuinely revolutionary organisation. Okay, but we can't leave it just at that. We have to look more deeply at the content of different organisations' politics, not simply the technical definitions that they use. Because the reality is, on the far left, that among the advocates of the degenerated workers' state theory, there are a whole series of gradations. You know, here in Australia, unfortunately, we have the Spartacist League, who make it a point of pride to champion the vilest, most reactionary Stalinist regimes that they can find, and, you know, viciously denounce anybody who doesn't enthusiastically support these states' right to nuclear weapons. Oh, you have the DSP, which I cited earlier, that has for the last 30 years sycophantically praised almost every nationalist or populist leader that has had even a hint of leftist coloration. At the other end of the spectrum, there are people from the Trotskyist tradition who are in some cases hard critics and opponents of Stalinism and of the Stalinist regimes that continue to exist. So that's one factor. I think the other thing that you need to take into account is the political context in which political groups operate. The sort of framework of the debate amongst the far left that I've outlined really is a Western framework, I think, the way the debate was thrashed out amongst the Trotskyists. Actually, the debate in the Arab world, for example, has been totally different. And so I think you need to take that into account when you're talking about what we say about different political currents in other parts of the world. And I think that starts to point to the question which is, in a way, the key to all of this. That, yes, a revolutionary party needs to have a worldview, needs to have an analysis of history, of the underlying economic and social contradictions in the capitalist order that create the possibility of socialism. It needs to be equipped to instill an understanding of the totality of society, a Marxist understanding in its members. And, you know, in the future, the analysis of what went wrong in Russia is going to be a major part of that. But the truth still remains that for all the brilliant historical analysis in the world will actually not help an organisation one bit if it cannot formulate the right answers to the questions of today. And that is fundamentally how organisations and political currents have to be judged, on their program and their policies for the class struggle in the here and now. Take, for example, Communist Refoundation in Italy. It was hailed as an example to emulate by advocates of the broad party model of the socialist, on the socialist left. But after playing an important positive role in mobilising against the Iraq War, pension cuts and some other things, its leadership swung sharply to the right, joining the centre-left coalition government and then voting to support Italian participation in the Afghanistan War and for a range of anti-working class domestic policies. Total betrayal. But our critique of Refoundation is not that it didn't have a clear line on the Russian question. It's that they didn't have a revolutionary program for Italy in 2000 and, well, whatever it was. It didn't reject the idea that change could be achieved through Parliament, didn't stand for the revolutionary overthrow of the Italian state. That is, our argument is a critique, not of something to do with Russia, but more broadly a critique of their reformist politics. Yeah. Or take the other radical left parties in Europe. In France, the Trotskyist LCR has recently dissolved itself into the broader anti-capitalist party. Now, we can debate the merits or otherwise of this, and I think there's arguments on both sides, but it would be profoundly unhelpful to see the key question in the debate is their analysis of the USSR. Now, this isn't to say that the Russian question, the question of Stalinism, is irrelevant. In fact, part of their appeal is that they're seen as being a radical alternative to the failed French Communist Party. But Besancenot's critique of the communists is more about its right-wing policies in France than anything to do with Russia. And one of their main points of differentiation from the communists is their principled refusal to participate in any centre-left coalition governments. They argue that a critique of capitalism, not just neoliberalism, is necessary if the left is to go forward. Now, there's all kind of legitimate arguments in all of this about, you know, whether the program of the new party is too vague. You know, some people say it's not clear enough on the question of revolution, smashing the capitalist state and so on. Others say that it will be able to evolve that way in the future. Okay, that's a legitimate debate, but the fundamental point is that even though broader historical questions, not least the Russian experience, bear on this and are raised by it, actually, the core argument has to be about the program for the class struggle and for winning socialism today. But all that said, I think it's important to challenge an idea that has come up numerous times on the left over the past few years in connection with the argument around so-called broad parties. And that argument is that the left needs to get over the arcane debates of the past, move beyond its historical divisions and present a united front against the right. And I actually think this is a very dangerous argument and one that needs to be resisted. Because the arcane debates being talked about are not just about the precise words you use to characterise the former Soviet states. What's under attack, I think, is the need to build a distinctly revolutionary party with a clear programme. It's an attempt to dismiss any hard political positions as being sectarian and to say that the doctrines of Marxism are antiquated and unnecessary for a changed and changing world. The reality, though, is that the crisis in world capitalism, now almost universally acknowledged, poses the need not only for a critique of the free market and organisations built on, you know, the basis of class struggle politics, but organisations are needed that have an alternative vision, a systematic worldview. And in a period of deep crisis, there is no necessary counterposition at all between having a clearly articulated and defined Marxist program and being able to win a mass following. At the end of World War I, or in the Great Depression of the 1930s in Australia, it was not simply a broad anti-capitalism, but a vision of communism that rallied workers into the communist parties around the world. Similarly, it's been in the great crises of the system that the strategic and tactical questions of revolutionary strategy, such as the approach needed to win workers from social democracy, or debates over the necessity or otherwise for the workers' movement to challenge for power, that have been most sharply posed at these times. What can seem like arcane disputes amongst small groups of socialists on the margins of political debate can assume huge significance when millions of people begin to look for the tools with which to transform society. And to grasp this, we only need to look at the last period of radical upheaval, the 1960s and the early 1970s. As the radicalisation deepened, debates about the kind of party that was needed, the kinds of strategies that should be pursued, gained a whole new urgency and momentum. And, you know, for example, one of the best pamphlets that we have on these questions is called Party and Class, which contains a series of articles on the nature of the Revolutionary Party, the real history of Bolshevism in Russia, and so on. And I think it's instructive that this was published in the 1970s, when precisely these debates were engaging more and more layers of newly radicalising people.
Is it 35?
Yeah. Not only that, the radicalisation of the 60s and 70s spurred a whole new generation of social historians to go back and re-examine the Russian Revolution and engage in path-breaking work that unearthed new things about the real dynamic of the revolution from under the Stalinist mythology of the sort of omnipotent Bolshevik leadership. That is, they rediscovered a revolution that was driven by the organisation and the struggle of Russian workers from the ground up. And there's nothing specific about the Russian question in terms of this. In the midst of the Russian Revolution itself, Lenin returned to re-examine Marx's writings about the history of the Paris Commune, which was then half a century earlier, in order to come to grips with the tasks confronting his party in 1917. Trotsky had done the same thing with regards to the 1848 revolutions and what Marx had to say about them when he was trying to evaluate what had happened in Russia in 1905. Or look at what's happening in America today. Joe Allen has talked about the debate about socialism opening up in the US. You know, here's a debate about politics that is also inevitably, I think, going to become a debate about history, about Russia, about the Cold War, about the US labour movement and its failings, but also, you know, the history of working class resistance and socialism in the US that stretches back well over 100 years. And, you know, the Russian question hasn't come up there yet, but really, I would challenge anyone to be bold enough to argue that the question of what happened in Russia is not going to come up in these debates over socialism in the next few years. So the notion that history is just in the past, that its debates have nothing to tell us about today, is, I think, a myth of the long era of relative stability in the capitalist order. And as that stability is washed away, as I think it will be, in the coming years, I would confidently predict that the debates over the history of the socialist movement, and particularly the history of the Russian Revolution and how it was defeated, will become more, not less relevant for the new generation of socialists that will once again confront the daunting and the awe-inspiring task of trying to work out how to transform the world in which we live. And I'll leave it there.